We'll call the joint committee meeting with the Agricultural, Environment, Natural Resources, Finance, Ag Policy, Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, Jobs, and Economic Opportunity Policy, and Finance, and Technology, Bioscience, and Medical Products Division to order. And we do not officially have a quorum, but we're going to get going. We have quite a few wonderful people here to testify today. And we're going to have an overview today of agricultural industrial bioscience in Minnesota. The meeting has been called to order. When we have enough where it can kind of maybe be like a quorum or something, we'll recall it to order. We are not going to work on the approval of the minutes today. We'll save that for special thanks to Lynn Osterman. She put a lot of work in putting this together, and we want to thank her. As I said, this is an overview of agricultural industrial bioscience in Minnesota, and we're going to get right into the testimony. Our first person to testify is Gene Goddard from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Welcome to the committee, sir, and if you could please make your presentation.
Mr. Chair of the Committee, my name is Gene Goddard. I'm the Bioscience Industry Specialist for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We have a series of, this is part of our Bioscience 101 series of hearings that we've had around the Capitol over the last couple weeks. Today's hearing is to focus on ag and industrial biosciences to help the legislator and the committee better understand that biotechnology in Minnesota is not just human health, that it involves ag and industrial products, that it involves opportunities throughout greater Minnesota. I think you may have heard me mention this in a committee before, that 20 years ago when I was a freshman at Southwest State University coming off my family farm, I wanted to be a science major, so I started off as a chemistry physics major. At that time, there weren't a lot of opportunities for somebody that was interested in science and stay in greater Minnesota to get a job. So I was forced to change my major at the end of my sophomore year because I didn't want to leave the farming community. I wanted to stay in greater Minnesota and help grow companies there. Today, there's tremendous opportunity for that type of a person if they're coming out of high school to get a job in greater Minnesota at many one of our ag processing facilities, at the ethanol plants, at some of the vaccine facilities in the Worthington area that provide pharmaceuticals to the hog and the dairy industry. Today we have a series of presentations that will help highlight that opportunity for kids coming out of the farm today or in smaller communities in greater Minnesota to get a science background and get a well-paying job and stay in greater Minnesota. The presenters that we have today are Louis Duvalier from Cargill. He's going to talk about ag oils and industrial lubricants made from ag products. We have Clint Calvert from the University's Hormel Institute. He'll talk about food and how food affects human health. We have Wayne Fries from a company in Worthington called Newport Laboratories, and he'll talk about vaccines. We have Mike Van Erdrick from the a company called Bioverse that has facilities in Pipestone and in Bloomington to show how a company can have multiple facilities in the state. And then lastly, we have Dean of the College of Natural Resources, I'm sorry. College of Agriculture, COFAS, Associate Dean from the university to talk about some of the programs there as well. And we'll start off with Luis Valle from the university, or from Cargill, to make his presentation.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, my name is Luis Del Valle. I'm the Global Marketing Director with Cargill Industrial Oils and Lubricants.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. And I'm not sure if I'm getting any power here with the projector.
Representative Heigerken?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if probably the other part of the committee might be down in the basement.
That's probably a good place for him. No, there's no outside the door, and Lynn Osterman and others have been down there telling him to come up.
Also, thank you.
But good point. And our biotechnology isn't working too well here right now, looks like.
This is electronics.
Electronic biotechnology.
I think I could probably talk for that.
What we could do is maybe go to Kurt Markham and let's...
No, actually, I could go ahead and speak without it because I have a presentation here and Yes. There we go.
Okay, if we could have the pages, please pass. Yep. Pass those out. Oh.
I have a dozen copies there, so you could pass them around. As many of you know, Cargill is a local private company in agribusiness, various forms of agribusiness. My particular business unit is called Cargill Industrial Oils and Lubricants, and it's one of the divisions within Cargill which is focused on industrial products. Our mission is to be the leading global supplier of fats, oils, and environmentally advantaged products to targeted industrial markets. Do you have handouts that you've made it around yet? Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, kind of on the, for those of you with presentations, on the third slide down, there's a chart which basically has some inputs and outputs. And what industrial oils does is takes a series of ag-based inputs, things like soybean oil, linseed oil, canola, sunflowers, palm oil, tallow, and grease, and we process them. We do different research and development. We have a sales and marketing organization, technical service. We have various manufacturing processes and plants and supply chain management. And we focus on four or five different target industrial markets. Specifically, these are paints and coatings, hardboard, lubricants, transformer, fluids, and metalworking textiles. In paints and coatings, for example, in oil-based paints, you have a large percentage of mostly linseed oil, also soybean oil. Hardboard, use these oils as binders. So what I'd like to share with you today are some of the newer innovative products that we've developed. Excuse me.
Why don't we take just a minute, sir, and see if we can get this thing working here.
Okay.
Representative Cole.
We had a number of problems in the technology division when we had presentations, people getting things to work. So I'm not sure how this bodes for the industries, but I'm glad Cargill's here, and I want to thank the chair for organizing the joint hearing. This is something that I've wanted the division that I'm chairing to talk about, some of these agricultural applications for biosciences. So I think it's great that you're having the hearing today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coles.
I've just been informed that my computer doesn't work here.
Oh, it's you and not us. That's okay.
Did everyone get a handout copy?
And we're making more copies of the handouts. Should be here shortly. So,
okay.
If you could please continue.
Okay.
What kind of computer is that?
Dell.
Okay.
Anyway, so as I mentioned, so we're looking at various industrial markets to develop bio-based products. This slide titled Product Design Criteria, these are four key design attributes that we look at as we develop new products for the marketplace. First is we look at maximizing the renewable content. Maximizing the renewable content for these products. Not all products, because of their functionality, permit you to go 100% bio-based. Many times we have to use blends, we have to use derivatives of bio-based products. Oh, here we go. I think we're not on yet. So one is renewable content. Secondly, we obviously need to meet the relevant performance standards of the application. There's a definite requirement that you cannot compromise performance for products just because they are bio-based. So you need to meet the relevant performance standards. We also design them to be environmentally advantaged. That could be defined in various ways. One that is most common in the lubricants area and industrial oils area is biodegradability and toxicity. So those are two environmental attributes that are key to the marketing and success of our products. We also have products that affect the clean air, such as lower VOCs, lower volatile organic compounds, which are small forming precursors. And last but not least, since we are in... I'll just tell you my password. Is that it must provide customer value. Specifically, we say customer value on a life cycle cost basis. Many of these products, these bio-based products, on a per pound or per gallon initial cost basis do cost more than their petroleum or petrochemical counterparts. But we always seek for ways to look for total life cycle cost value, whether it's disposition cost savings, extended life, and so we're always looking to provide customer value on these products. So that's what we design into the product. And so I wanted to share with you today four or five of the products that we have commercialized today and are near commercialization, and just to kind of give you a flavor for the type of products that Cargill and other bio-based manufacturers have been putting out. The first product is called OxyCure. OxyCure is a trademark Cargill product, which is a low VOC paint solution. If you recall, I mentioned that a lot of our linseed and soybean oils go into the paints markets. Well, due to regulation in lower VOC requirements, primarily in California and in the Northeast U.S., there is an increase in demand for low VOC alkyd resin technology. This is a line of product that enables the oil-based paints to continue to flow and have the proper properties while lowering the VOCs traditionally that are associated with solvents in those paints. Cargill has a line of products. We commercialized them last year. They're now gaining popularity. They have anywhere from 80 to 100% renewable content. And as I mentioned, these are commercially available and in various stages of testing with customers, such as the paint companies you would see at a Home Depot or Walmart, someone, a Sherwin-Williams or a Bayer, someone like that would use this kind of technology in their formulations. Next product on the list, I call it Novus THF. This is a tractor hydraulic fluid. Novus is another Cargill trademark name that we sell. This is a product designed for agricultural equipment, primarily like John Deere tractors. And oh, here we go. Wait. John Deere tractors, JIKs. All your tractors use primarily a petroleum-based tractor hydraulic fluid. And this is a product that we introduced a couple of years ago, and it's a 50% renewable content. This is an example where we tried 100%, it doesn't work. So we go with 50%. I mentioned here, too, just as a side, that this meets the Farm Bill bio-based requirement. One of the key market drivers we see across the U.S. is the 2002 Farm Bill, U.S. Farm Bill, which has the bio-based products initiatives, which calls for federal government procurement preference for bio-based products that meet certain applicable standards and certain minimum renewable content. This, along with all these products I mentioned today, are designed to meet those requirements because we see that as the federal government bio-based procurement as an early adopter of this kind of technology. Similar to the tractor hydraulic fluid, the next one is Novus 300. This is a mobile hydraulic fluid specifically designed for a Caterpillar specification. If you see all the highway construction around here and the Cat equipment out there, excavators, bulldozers, etc., Caterpillar is the major OEM that has a biodegradable specification. Up till now, the specification could only be met with petrochemical-based components to meet the biodegradable spec. Cargill has developed and been working closely with Caterpillar for 4 years now to develop a product that has a 25% renewable content. Again, to meet the Farm Bill, support ag, in addition to having the environmental footprints of biodegradability toxicity. And if you think of all the highway construction equipment, forestry, etc., we feel this is a very useful product. We're in the final stages of development right now and field testing with Caterpillar, so we're hoping to have an announcement of the product launch this summer. A couple other products, Novus Anti-Wear Hydraulic Oil. This is a hydraulic oil based with a 60% renewable, which is used by general industry. Factories, manufacturing plants, steel mills, auto factories, small industry plants use a wide range of hydraulic systems throughout their factory operation, and this is a product that's bio-based. Again, the key benefit environmentally is it's biodegradable, non-toxic. So if there is any kind of spill, it's much more environmentally benign. And kind of last but not least, I wanted to mention a product here that has gained substantial market interest in the last 2 to 3 years, and it is a transformer fluid used by electrical utilities in their transformers that is called, it's actually made by Cargill, and it's marketed by an electrical manufacturer called Cooper Power Systems out of Wisconsin. They're the number one transformer manufacturer in North America. And we formed an alliance with them where they market this fluid to electrical utilities throughout North America. And just to kind of give you the perspective here, in electrical transformers today, there's 75 million gallons of petroleum used. These are new transformers and retrofill of existing transformers across the U.S. Most of this, 95% plus, is petroleum-based. We're finally live here on my second to last slide. Is petroleum based, but this is a formula. Again, it's soybean based. It is biodegradable, non-toxic. There are also other attributes that make it attractive. It extends the life of these transformers just because of the unique interaction between the cellulose paper in the transformer and the soybean oil, both natural substances. We've, in the last 4 years, been able to get to 1 or 2% market share, which we consider a success in the bio-based product category. And we have an aggressive growth program with Cooper to convert the whole, as much of this market to bio-based within the next 5 years. To give you an appreciation for the potential, is if all 75 million gallons a year of transformer fluid in the U.S. went soy-based, it would immediately replace 75 million gallons of petroleum, and it would require 1.2 million acres of new soybean production. The state of Minnesota has about 7.5 million acres of soybean in it. So you're talking about new production just for this product category that could equal more than 10% of the state's crop. So this is just a snapshot of 5 or 6 products that Cargill has in the market today that are bio-based, based on sound bioscience and technical specifications for a particular application. I just want to share with you, we have 3 or 4 products in various stages of product development that we hope to announce over the next 12 to 24 months. Things like bio-based two-cycle oils. These are oils used by outboards, by snowmobiles, chainsaw, lawn equipment. We have products there. We have biodegradable greases used in various industrial and automotive applications. And one of the biggest challenges we have is a bio-based motor oil. When you look at the entire lubricant portfolio of demand, the engine oil, the motor oil, this is oil that you use in your car and is used in diesel trucks and equipment, is by far the biggest category of lubricants. They're very demanding technically to meet the performance requirements, but we've had a program in place for the last 2 or 3 years for both passenger car and diesel trucks that We hope to have a product available that are bio-based in these two categories. And by bio-based, I mean it may be soybean, it may be canola, it may be animal fat. We have to look at all the physical attributes of the bio-based components, pick those that work the best, and go with those. So that's basically it for my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, either now or later on.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the witness at this point? If you could, yeah, Griffin Mahoney.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but
that's Luis.
Luis. Cargill is a big company and wide has operations in many different locations. But where does most of your R&D get done, and where do most of these products get manufactured?
Most of the R&D is done here in Cargill out in Wayzata. We do have our research center. It's our oils and fats research center, so a lot of the basic R&D is done here. We also work with customers around the and potential partners around the country. For example, with Caterpillar, we're doing a lot of the work with them in Peoria at their headquarters, at their R&D center. Our industrial oils, we do have industrial oils plants throughout the U.S. and throughout the world, for that matter. In this case, some of the final blending and manufacturing of these products are made in Chicago, which is where our main paints and coatings plant is. However, the raw materials, the ingredients, whether they're soybean, canola, are sourced throughout the Midwest. I'm sure much comes from here. We also have plants in South America. And we basically will grow as the customer demand grows. This transformer fluid, for example, that I mentioned, we've been seeing a lot of growth out in the West Coast, in California specifically, and at the appropriate time, we'll probably set up production out there.
Representative Mahoney?
One other question. Just as a whole, you know, this business is how many millions of people
It's hard to say total acres because you have, this is just one segment of the bio industrial product, the lubricant segment. Obviously you have biofuels, things like biodiesel, ethanol, and you have bioplastics, you have other bio-based products. But just to put in perspective, the transformer market, I mentioned 1.2 million acres of beans needed for that. The Caterpillar hydraulic fluid would probably be close to that same amount. So I could easily envision probably 4 to 5 million acres just to meet, say, soybean and crop demand to meet these industrial lubricants over the next, say, 10 years.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I ask that is that, I've been pretty much in the bioscience, involved with it since its beginning here at the legislature, which is just 3 or 4 years ago. And every time I dig into it a little deeper, I'm amazed at how far it spreads out. And this is the first year I've really been kind of looking into the ag stuff of it. And potentially ultimately millions and millions of acres. So if you'd ever come up with that number, or just a guess, a better guess than
we'll let you know. And I'm sure, I know those numbers are out there, and I just have just not privy to them, or I've not seen them, but I do know there are some numbers out there with ag associations. Yeah. Also, there are other divisions within Cargill looking at this that would probably have that information, so I'll get back to
because it's easier to sell to my colleagues and our colleagues. The more numbers that you use when we get to say it's 10 million acres versus just 10,000 acres,
right,
their eyes get a little bit bigger.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the witness? Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Duval?
Del Valle.
I'm a farm kid, so I really screwed it up.
Just call him sir.
Yeah, sir. I noticed your partnerships with Caterpillar and with John Deere. Would you be one of the byproducts in development, you said, is for upwards and maybe even some snowmobiles. Would you partner with Polaris and Arcticat? Have you started that?
Absolutely. We speak to the major equipment manufacturers. Sometimes they're general industry specs. A lot of these products, since they are, we are plowing new ground here as far as new technology. We do almost always have a OEM partner. And we have been working with, we also work with other additive companies and technical organizations like SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers, those folks.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you.
No, thank you, Mr.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Duvalier.
Thank you.
Next on my list, I have Glenn Thuringer. Or do we want to go? Who would you like next?
Next, we'd like to have Bev Durgan, Associate Dean from the College of Agricultural, Food, and Environmental Sciences. She and I both have to be over at the Capitol for the bonding conference committee in about 15 minutes, so that's why we're adjusting the agenda a little bit.
Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Bev Durgan, Associate Dean for Research in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota. And it's a pleasure for me to be here with you today. I'm not on the agenda, so I appreciate you allowing me to speak a little bit about the University of Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. Biosciences, that's a profession that continues to this day. The question that we continue to see is, can we match efforts on the East Coast and the West Coast to provide well-educated professionals and staff start in the state. From our perspective, University of Minnesota...
Ms. Durgan, excuse me, could you please take the microphone?
And is that better? I'm sorry.
Much better.
Okay. Sorry about that. Thanks. I won't start over. Okay, thank you. Today I'd like to briefly highlight only a subset of the University of Minnesota's efforts that have and will continue to support the state's bioscience-based industries. I want to underscore the opportunities that the university, your sole research institution, sees in the biosciences. As you know, one of the three major components of the university's biannual request is specific to the biosciences, and that's Biosciences for a Healthy Society. The Biosciences for a Healthy Society component of the biannual request includes four key areas that President Brunix refers to as interdisciplinary hallmarks of his administration. These include healthy foods for healthy lives, new products through biotechnology, translational research in human health, and brain functions across the lifespan. Today I'd like to just limit my remarks to two of these four areas, knowing that several of the other speakers, and specifically my colleagues from the University's Hormel Institute, will talk about the other two. Having said that, today I would like to describe how the university is integrating agriculture, food, nutrition, and medicine. And the goals of our research are to integrate interdisciplinary strengths from plant biology and breeding through the continuum of consumption and health, prevent diet-related chronic diseases and obesity through diet, exercise, and human behavior, and enhance food safety across all stages from farm to table. I'd like to just briefly cite some of the research activities that have been conducted to date under the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives Initiative. One of those is being conducted in southern Minnesota at our Southern Research and Outreach Center with our researchers from that site, plus in St. Paul, looking at various varieties of vegetables, kale, broccoli, and cabbage under various growing conditions to increase the level of healthy anti-cancer properties in these vegetables and hopefully to make them taste better. Researchers in food science and nutrition are determining how the consumption of soy-based products affect breast cancer and how the consumption and the positive interaction of whole grain foods interact with health. Researchers in entomology, and you may have just recently seen this story in the Star Tribune, teamed up with colleagues in the medical school to investigate promising anti-HIV properties in bee propolis. So you also may be aware that the University of Minnesota has just received several large federal research grants. Two of these grants were the largest that has ever been awarded by the USDA. These grants were made possible in part by the state funding that you provide to the university and also our focus on integrating agriculture, food, nutrition, and medicine. These federal grants will be here in Minnesota and will be used to conduct research on issues that affect Minnesotans. Some of you may be aware of the large Homeland Security grant that the university received that establishes one of three post-harvest food protection and defense centers in the nation. Another one was a large USDA grant for the research on Yoni's disease in dairy cattle and PRRS disease in swine. Other university interdisciplinary initiatives in the bioscience enable renewable resources such as forests, grasslands, wheat and corn raised by farmers to become raw products for our energy needs. One of these examples is what is currently happening out in West Central Minnesota at our West Central Research and Outreach Center. And this will be highlighted on April 22nd, which is, happens to be Earth Day. On that day, we will commission our 230-foot high wind turbine, the first turbine at one of our research and outreach centers. This turbine will generate half of the electricity that is needed to run the University of Minnesota campus at Morris. And to that, to us, that's a very exciting possibility. But it doesn't really end there. This is the first stage of a three-stage plan to demonstrate and conduct research in stored energy with hydrogen, fuel mixing, value-added products such as the production of fertilizer. Many partners have come together to make this vision a reality. They include partners with not only our university, other universities, non-governmental agencies, and private companies, both large and small. Further, what we're very excited about is that the Morris campus in time will become a model for commercial application of biomass and heating and cooling and research to ensure the economic stability of biomass systems and the effects of biofuels on real rural economies. So we're hoping that you'll join us on April 22nd in Morris to celebrate this unique partnership and really looking at the effect of biofuel and biomass on rural economies. Ultimately, all of our bioscience capabilities in the state address three key areas: the health of Minnesota citizens, the health of the landscape, and the health of our economy. All biosciences ultimately address quality of life. We feel the time is right and the place is right now for biosciences, and that Minnesota has really all the right steps that we need to move forward. We have a unique land-grant university surrounded by 400-plus food companies, prominent agribusinesses, as you'll hear today, rich and productive agriculture, a noted healthcare system, strong medical device, and bio-based technology companies. However, we really feel that we cannot leave these combined efforts to chance. We have to integrate, we have to develop partnerships, and we have to be intentionally interdisciplinary and take advantage of this. We at the university look forward to ongoing innovations in bioscience as we move forward the future with our partners, which includes the state, the private sector, other public entities, and the people of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Durgan? Thank you very much. Next, we'll have Mr. Wayne Fries. And could we get an invitation to that University of Minnesota Morris ribbon cutting or open house or whatever it is?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes. We will send you an invitation and hope to see you there.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Wayne Free, CEO, Newport Laboratories, Worthington, Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I'm Glenn Thuringer with the City of Worthington, and I've been working with Lynn Osterman and Gene Goddard with the Bio 101 presentations we're putting on. As you heard, Gene has got to leave. I'm going to step in and help with the introductions. Wayne will be here speaking on behalf of the City of Worthington, and we'll continue on with the order that we gave you.
Thank you, sir. Please proceed.
Thank you for inviting me here, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to today maybe get my PowerPoint presentation going here before I start.
Okay.
And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what's going on out in southwestern Minnesota for bioscience, and a little in the process of mentioning a little bit about our companies. I'll go through that. And then I'd like to tell you what some of our concerns are in that particular business climate in southwest Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. While we're waiting for the technology to join us, I was going to make a few comments regarding Worthington when Wayne was done, but I'll take advantage of it now.
Certainly. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Glenn Thuringer. I'm with the Worthington Regional Economic Development Corporation.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. Wayne is going to be talking, as you mentioned, about the biosciences, specifically in Worthington. Wanted to make sure that everybody here was aware of our involvement with the bonding bill, that we are supporting the Bioscience Park infrastructure dollars that are in that, in the, both the House and the Senate version. And in Worthington, next to the campus setting that Newport Holdings, Prairie Holdings Group has, we have a 55-acre Bioscience Park, and we're working with the bonding committee to be able to get funding for the infrastructure, the dollars, and the dollars to help put that in. You'll see here in Wayne's presentation the value of the biosciences in Worthington and the immediate area. We are working with our local college to structure a lab tech training center that Wayne has been gracious enough in their future building that will be going up this summer, which is one of their R&D buildings. They're going to give us 2,000 square feet to get our lab tech training center started with the Minnesota West Community and Technical College. We'll be accepting our first students this fall. Through the assistance with the Blandin Foundation, we were able to dig deeply into our biosciences over the last couple of years and seen a desire and a very major need for industrial applied lab technicians, which will be the outcome of our lab tech training center. So we hope that we can have the support of any of you that are on the bonding bill conference committee in making the dollars available for the Bioscience Park infrastructure. I think Wayne is probably ready to, you know, be able to use the PowerPoint.
Does anyone here have a presentation that doesn't include a PowerPoint?
You have?
Mr. Markham? I think we'll go to Mr. Markham, and you can try and get that working there. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kurt Markham. I'm the Director of Ag Marketing Services for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Biotechnology has become increasingly important to the U.S. grain and livestock producers. There's still a lot of misinformation and fear-mongering that's going about biotechnology, especially to some of our international customers. Today, the precautionary principle is frequently invoked against biotech products and looms large in world trade, threatening U.S. exports to important markets, including China, the European Union, and even food donations to underdeveloped countries. The result's been some confusion and uncertainty amongst U.S. producers and traders as to the continued ability to market their products, and perhaps a greater reluctance by biotech firms to invest in products that fully demonstrate the vast potential of this technology. Fortunately, once people are given accurate information from credible sources, by and large, they are willing to accept that that biotechnology is a safe technology. We emphasize the word safe today. Food is an edible bioscience, as you just heard Cargill testify. And here in Minnesota, we are home to many food companies, large, medium, and small. Food sold in today's market is marketed on taste, convenience, and health attributes. Bioscience today helps all Minnesota companies develop new food products and attributes. The biofuels, biomaterial sector is largely becoming the most exciting in global agriculture. Not only will it profoundly affect the raw material demand, but it also is a magnet for farmer interest and excitement. The major steps forward in biomass conversion techniques and emerging biorefinery concepts offer technically feasible processes and reductions in costs that can achieve a goal of producing a greater portion of the nation's fuel supply from renewable resources. Realizing this potential requires a serious commitment as expanding renewable fuel production to include lower value, higher availability biomass, and I'm speaking about cellulose here, corn and corn stover, and feedstocks such as grasses, straws, waste wood, paper, and others. However, cost-effective commercial-scale production requires targeted research and market-based incentives and market drivers and significantly stronger national policy focus. The Governor's Ethanol Coalition is currently working on a recommendation for this for Congress right now. We hope to have that out by the end of the month. Further, we should ensure that the resources are provided to address the utilization of cellulose associated with the kernel of corn and corn stover. This will make cellulosic production more efficient, leverage our investments in existing production facilities, and increase farm income. It also offers a cost-effective and efficient transition model to expand the production of ethanol from other cellulosic materials. U.S. farmers continue to endorse biotechnology as a valuable tool to reduce costs and enhance productivity. Thank you, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mark. Any questions for the witness? Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I'm sorry, I don't really have a history with you because I don't serve on a committee that you deal with, so maybe this is old hat to the Environment Committee, but you started out with an attack on the precautionary principle, and I'm wondering what that's about. Does the department oppose the precautionary principle?
Mr. Markham?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. We support the precautionary principle with sound scientific facts.
Representative Park?
Mr. Chair, why don't you tell us what the precautionary principle is? I'm not sure everybody knows, but it's really an important to the science that we're talking about. I just, if you could tell us how you define it and what is acceptable, I just was a little taken back because that was your first testimony. I mean, you went on to say some other things that sounded fine, but it sounded like you have this big problem with precautionary principle that you laid out. So maybe you could just say, you know, inform us all what you do think about is positive about precautionary principle.
Mr. Markham?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, precautionary principle, I'm looking at it in the context of the agricultural stakeholders in that we know what we grow. We're careful, and it's a go-slow approach that people in agriculture have with biotechnology.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, just for the... I mean, has your committee talked about the precautionary principle? I don't want to go over ground that's maybe old hats for people, but our committee...
I thought that was more in the Health and Human Services Committee.
No, it isn't, Mr. Chair.
Oh, no, we haven't.
Okay. Well, basically, my understanding of it, and why it would even, why I presume you're bringing it up here, is that it starts with the premise that when there's a new product, we need to have that product prove that it's safe before it's put out, rather than just assume that something is safe and wait, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line when people are getting cancer and other sort of things. You have, the burden of proof starts out with the product. And so I'm glad that you're not against the precautionary principle, but it just you understand why I thought you were, because you started out with talking about how bad the precautionary principle was. So I guess maybe, I don't know. I don't know what to say. It sounded very negative, and now I understand that maybe it's not so.
Mr. Mark, what do you want to say?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, in terms of our position here with Minnesota Agriculture is we support the safe science of the university, but we have the approach of who are our stakeholders, which are 80,000 farmers in the state, of know what you grow, understand what you have, and in the case of the wheat producers, to be cautious, because wheat is really a food product.
Mr. Chair, we kind of agree then. Maybe I misunderstood you, or there's something you're referring to that is something more appropriate in agriculture that I don't know about. I'm not sure.
But to answer your question, Mr. Park, we have, the first time I've ever heard of this is like right now.
Okay. All right. Well, to be continued, I guess. Yeah.
When it comes to food, I just eat it. It doesn't matter. Any other questions for Mr. Markham? Okay, thank you, Mr. Markham.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that has a presentation that doesn't need a computer?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our next presenter is Mike Vanderdrick. He's from a small company called Bioverse. They have their corporate headquarters in Pipestone, Minnesota, and their marketing facility here in Bloomington.
Okay, Mr. Vanderwick. Vanderwick. Did I say that right?
Van Erdwick.
Oh, okay. Put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. Okay. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good afternoon, committee members, Chairman. My name is Mike Van Erdwick. I am the CEO of Bioverse Incorporated. And the reason I'm here today is I want to talk to you about four specific things. The four things are, one, give you a brief background and history on Bioverse, who we are, what we do. Two, tell you about the problem associated with Minnesota lakes today. Three, tell you about a solution of how to clean up Minnesota lakes. And four, give you a specific example of what Bioverse is doing today to clean up Minnesota ponds and lakes. Brief history on Bioverse. I am the founder and CEO of the company. Bioverse is a Minnesota corporation. I started Bioverse in 1995. We are headquartered in Pipestone, Minnesota, and we have a sales and marketing office in Bloomington, Minnesota. We are a biotech company focused on cleaning up water. That's all we do. 100% is clean up water. So we are a biotech company. We recently built a new manufacturing facility in the Job Z Zone in Pipestone. And we're excited about what strides we're making in the biotech field as far as cleaning up water. As far as the problem here in Minnesota with the lakes, what we're working to solve is that the problem with Minnesota lakes is there's too many nutrients coming into the lake. This is a major problem. It causes from fertilizer runoff, ag waste, leaves, grass clippings, bird waste, fish waste, everything that's blown, washed, dumped, or run off into a pond or a lake creates problems for that lake. It makes that lake out of balance. And a lot of people will come to me and say, geez, I've got an algae problem, or I got a sludge problem, or an odor problem with the pond or lake. And that is not the problem. That is the symptom. Okay? And chemicals can address the symptoms of the problem. They cannot solve the root cause of the problem, which is breaking down the organic matter and excess nutrients that is accumulating in the ponds and lakes here in Minnesota and elsewhere. We have spent the last 9-plus years developing technology and specific applications of how to address the root cause of that problem. We have patented dispensing systems that meter bacteria and enzymes into a body of water to break down the waste. The Bioverse has treated over 300,000 ponds, and by our definition, a pond is anything 10 acres or less. A lake is greater than 10 acres. But over 300,000 ponds in the last 5 years. We've treated many lakes. We do a lot of work for municipalities, golf courses, and the like with stormwater runoff, retention ponds, that type of thing. Our technology and our solution to this problem is this biosphere or bioreactor contains three main components inside here. First, dozens of strains and species of naturally occurring beneficial microorganisms to break down the organic matter and the waste. In addition to the microorganisms, we also put nutrients, vitamins, minerals, buffers, things to make the conditions right for the bacteria and microorganisms to grow. The third component is a growth media that holds the nutrients in place, creates a large surface area for the bacteria to grow and colonize on. What you really end up with is a ferment or an incubator that produces huge amounts of bacteria. The bacteria produce large amounts of enzymes, and together they break down the organic matter and remove that from the lake or pond. This is designed a similar technology that is used in the wastewater treatment industry. This is really a miniature wastewater treatment plant. My background is a biologist and a chemist. I worked for an engineering firm designing and building wastewater treatment plants before I started the company. So it's proven technology, it's safe, and very, very cost effective. Lastly, I'll give you a specific example of what we're doing here in Minnesota. Got a 30-plus page report of a lake that we treated here in Plymouth. We treated Schmidt Lake. It's a 37-acre lake located in Plymouth, Minnesota, in Hennepin County, for 5 months last year. In 5 months, we were able to reverse about 10 years worth of aging or eutrophication in that lake. We improved the water clarity. We improved the water quality. We reduced nutrients. We had an independent party come in and specifically monitor and measure how much we were able to improve that lake. And just one example of what we're doing. We're very excited about continuing our efforts to clean up Minnesota surface waters.
Sir, what, Mr. Vanderdwick, what's in that thing? What is that?
It's basically it's microorganisms. It's bacteria. It's naturally occurring microorganisms that are already found in Minnesota's lakes, and we're just providing it in the right combination and concentrations to supplement what Mother Nature does naturally to offset all the amount of nutrients coming into the lake.
Now, we just opened one up. Is that okay?
Yes. Yes.
My hand's starting to wither away. Ooh, I hate that. Okay, Representative Erdahl, and then Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
Mike.
Mike.
Mike. You said Schmidt Lake you treated with this?
Correct.
And how many of you drop those in the lake? Is that it?
Mr. Mander?
Correct. Schmidt Lake is 37 acres. I've got brought two sizes with me. The 6-inch sphere, which treats up to a quarter acre. The 10-inch sphere treats up to one surface acre. The 1 acre, the sphere the gentleman is holding, is biodegradable. Okay, that sphere completely biodegrades in the water, which is another biotech product that that we're using in conjunction with some of the other companies. The black spheres are plastic spheres. They need to be removed at the end of 30 days. So we used 37 one-acre spheres per month for 5 months.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, so how much, you said it was cost-effective. How much does that cost to do? Since I have a lake that I live on that's full of algae and similarly sized.
Mr. Vanderbilt. You may have a sale here.
It's cost effective. It was about $500 per acre for the year, so it was about $16,000 last year to treat a 37-acre lake. It is estimated, there's a Bemidji State University has a report out that correlates the value of the properties with the amount of clarity in the lake. We estimate that we increase the property values around Schmidt Lake somewhere between $250,000 and $500,000 based on a $16,000 investment.
Representative Erdahl?
I'm interested in selling some of my lakeshore property.
You better wait.
I'll wait a little bit.
Just wait a little bit. Thank you. Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that you've done some cleaning up of wastewater treatment systems. Have you done any work or thought of doing any work in the area of septic systems?
Yes, we have a actual different product for specifically designed for septic systems. We have actually many different products from bird bath water cleaners, fountain water cleaners, stock tank water cleaners. I'm talking to you today about our pond and lake water cleaners, but we are in the business of cleaning water.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me a little bit more about the septic systems?
The septic, thank you. The septic treatment product actually is a water-soluble bag that you just put in the toilet and flush right down the toilet, and it ends up out into the septic system. The bag breaks down. It's using bacteria to keep the septic lines cool, the drain field clear, and break down and liquefy the waste.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
just a question about the longevity of the bacteria. Do you do follow-ups on these lakes or on the, any of the other situations that you're working with? I mean, is this something that's done once and then it's over? You know, do you go back and double-check to see what's happening?
Yes, thank you. The each sphere is designed to last approximately 30 days. And so depending on how many months you decide to treat the pond or the lake will determine what water clarity that you ultimately end up with.
Are there any downsides at all in terms of long-term impact on whatever's living in that lake? Fish, or the all the other critters?
We use this product in aquaculture and fish farms. It's completely safe for fish. What we're trying to do is bring a lake that's out of balance back into balance. And so for every action, there is a reaction. But the reaction is to get the lake back to the balanced condition that it was in originally.
Representative Clark? Mr. Vanderwick, what does it do to atrazine?
I can't answer that.
You'll need to in about a week or so. Okay, Representative Johnson and Zellers. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Erdrich, it might be a bit of a stretch, but have you thought of any applications of your products with feedlot lagoons?
Mr. Van Erdrich?
We have thought of that and have not actively pursued that at this time. It's something that we are confident that our product would treat as feedlot lagoons in the agriculture industry.
Thank you.
Yep.
Johnson. And there are some companies out there that are working on some different chemicals and so forth for this, you know, for the smell of lagoons, which would be quite a breakthrough. They don't smell. Oh, that's true. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Vanderwick, I say this a little bit jokingly, but do you have any products that work for weeds so that in front of my mother-in-law's cabin to earn my visits each summer I can spend a little bit more time on the lake than cutting the weeds and towing those out, or are you strictly surface area and water quality bacteria?
Vanderwick. Thank you. Our product would not have any impact on rooted aquatic vegetation. So our product can be used as a in conjunction with certain chemicals in lakes to have a combined lake management program. We're not saying that our product will solve every single problem in a lake, but it will certainly solve one of the major problems facing the lakes today.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for the witness? Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Thuringer.
Mr. Chair, we're going to try to use the overhead to project. We think it'll work just fine. Regarding the livestock lagoon question, there is a company in Worthington that it has a microbial product that is coming onto the market to address that issue as well.
Representative Hamilton. Question? Okay. Please proceed.
Wayne, go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to, sorry for the delay and getting this going. I'd like to go ahead and proceed, Chairman, with my presentation. My name is Wayne Freeze. I'm from Worthington, Minnesota. Went to school at Iowa State University and picked up my master's here at the University of Minnesota. I want to just briefly tell you a little bit about our businesses, which will dovetail into what we're doing with biosciences. Our group is situated in Worthington, Minnesota, and basically the three businesses on the upper part of the screen are the core businesses that we work with. What do we do in these businesses? As commonly said, well, we make livestock vaccines, and we provide livestock services, and we also provide animal health services from many states in the country. Our group employs about 175 people, almost 150 full-time, and 26 part-time positions. This last year, we have provided just about 39 jobs in that southwestern Minnesota area. Typically, in years past, we will add about 20 people, and generally speaking, the part-time jobs move into full-time jobs later on. Our payroll is $6.5 million, and if you took executive salaries out of there and benefits out of there, our average hourly wage is around $18. And this is a group of veterinarians that have about 25 other staff people that work with them, and they also function in these other states, as I think is in your handouts. And again, there's a close correlation between the businesses and how they do work. Our ProPig group of businesses employs about 50 people, and basically we provide ag services and also function for retained ownership feeding in northwest Iowa and also southwest Minnesota. And again, these states are people that we're bringing investor owners out of these states, and we're feeding livestock in southwest Minnesota. Newport Laboratories, the group of people that I work with in Newport Laboratories in the early 70s and 80s developed a laboratory called Oxford Laboratory that is still in Worthington, Minnesota. And that particular facility is on the southwest edge of town. This facility was built in 81 and added on to in 91. And this facility was sold to Upjohn in the late 80s. Upjohn sold it to Bayer, and Bayer sold it to Intervet. It currently produces a number of swine vaccines, and the vaccines are shipped down to Kansas City to the Intervet facilities for bottling. A little background on where we're at and where we've come from. Our group, I left the laboratory in 1994 and went back into production agriculture and got involved with a number of different things. But during that journey, we decided to put a new laboratory in to fill what we thought was a niche market, but it's grown considerably. In the past, we were in the commercial vaccines, and you had plants you had Solvay Laboratories in Minneapolis here, and you had Oxford Laboratories in Worthington, Minnesota. And our facility that we got licensed in 1997 is the one in the middle, and we've put on various additions since then. We've just completed a research facility out in the country in Minnesota. And so what do? In a nutshell, we make custom-made vaccines. And a good example of a custom-made vaccine would be the flu vaccine that's made every year for human beings. And what we mean by custom is the isolates, the organisms are changed every year, so you come out with a new vaccine. And that's what's kind of happening on a scale that's gaining momentum in agriculture. We currently make vaccines for 15% of the hog population in the United States. And we think it's going to continue growing fairly rapidly. That's why we think we're a very viable industry in southwest Minnesota. And again, 60% of our business is with swine, and 33% is with cattle. And the cattle projects that we work with are in the Panhandle area, which is Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, as well as California. And again, I want to point out we're a relatively young company, but we've been going at it 8 years, and we've developed quite a bit of momentum. These are the various parts of the countries that we work with the most being in the Midwest. Second to that is the Southwest Panhandle area, whether it be cattle or swine, and then in the Southwest area. This is an example of where the corporate offices are of our competition. And I just want to point out we're the only one in Minnesota, and I think that's in your handout. And when American Home Products did buy Solvay, in the 90s, the corporate office was, or the Solvay was moved out of Minneapolis, kind of parceled out and taken down to Fort Dodge, Iowa. So we are the last remaining company, a vaccine company, that is headquartered in Minnesota here. This is a molecular diagnostics group that is growing fairly rapidly. And what do we need a molecular diagnostic group? We have about 25 cases a day come in from all over the country that are sending samples to us to diagnose. And again, we use different means of diagnostics to arrive at those conclusions. And this is just a picture of our R&D group. But what we've put in to help the bioscience industry in Minnesota is a DNA sequencing machine that would be very similar to what you see on CSI. On the TV stations. We're one of two machines that is used in the veterinary world in this country.
isolates come to either the University of Minnesota or us. And this is the kinds of science that is rapidly growing and is what the larger systems want in this country. Again, just in action, we will get a number of samples on a weekly basis coming into here. And we can tell the difference between flu viruses. We can tell the difference between PRRS viruses and almost any bacteria that comes in. We've got a number of these organisms going on in the farm place. We can tell the system from month to month that things are changing. And we just used materials like this. This is just an example of a production group here. And how do you make vaccines? This is you make vaccines in roller bottles for virus vaccines, and an example, flu in humans. This is how you would do it. And again, we do this on a day-to-day basis. So having said that, we have also set up two manufacturing plants in other areas of the country. One was for a large integrated system in swine, and this was done in Goldsboro, North Carolina. This particular system was about 70,000 sows, produced about 1.4 million pigs a year, and they came to us and said, we want to buy your technology to put in our own laboratory for our own system. I've asked for permission to talk about this. We designed this facility ground up, sold them the technology, and they use it now to produce vaccine for not only their swine, but their turkey population, and they're the fourth largest turkey producer in this country. And again, we also have a facility in Sibley, Iowa, which is about 20 miles from Worthington. We did a complete remodeling this last year. And we set up a laboratory for, again, two vertically integrated systems in the swine world that wanted to produce their own vaccines. And why do they want to do this? Well, number one, because we can custom make it for their operation, and it usually is more effective. In the process, it usually is much cheaper. And we also have a facility that we're working with in Amarillo, Texas, that we're presently setting up a diagnostic lab, and this is a shot of the building. And again, it's kind of like the steel industry, where we went from huge plants to small, lower capitalized systems. Now, we would rather put those systems in Worthington, Minnesota, if we had the chance, and we would rather manage those for other systems out of North Carolina or the southwestern United States, and say, we'll put a laboratory in Worthington, Minnesota, and manage it for you. We do believe that most systems in the next 10 years will want their own vaccine laboratory, and we hope to be the people that do it. We are also designing a research facility for Worthington as we speak. And again, this is all occurring on the Prairie Expo 90-acre site that you probably heard once or twice about in Minneapolis here, but this was a tourist stop region that was to showcase Southwest Minnesota. And our group was able to, with the help of the state and for the most part, able to, in the Southwest region, buy this facility. And we're on the south part of this, right next to I-90 and 59, and then the north part is the bioscience park that we're trying to develop for the city of Worthington to attract in the other bioscience businesses for not only Worthington, but for the state. And again, just a few quick shots of the Prairie Expo site, which is our corporate office, and this is what it looked like if you never journeyed to Southwest Minnesota. Started out looking like this last year, when we were able to get the deal done, and it looked like this inside with a lot of displays, which included windmills, churches. We had some prairie scenes, and hopefully the idea was to let people in and hope they buy an ice cream cone and watch a movie. And this was the cafe, the gift shop, complete with gifts. And this was a train that was in that facility. So when we bought the facility with the contents, including banners, we had to figure out what to do with it. And so what we did with that facility is we started taking it apart last summer, and a lot of people did ask us how we got the train out of there, so five quick slides on how we got the train out. They put some tracks in. We had a local mover start pulling that train out, and just for your information, that's where it went. And we stopped the process going through Slayton, Minnesota, Representative Magnus's hometown there. And I thought we'd catch you on the golf course, but we didn't, Doug. But we did take it up to over the hill and through the valley to Curry, Minnesota. And that particular train was traded off for some Federal Department of Transportation debt and put in the end of the line Railroad Museum in
Tracy, Minnesota, or Curry, Minnesota. So then it was kind of back to reality with what we were going to do with this facility, and it was pretty bleak at that time. I kind of wondered if we hadn't made a mistake. So we took the cafe, started remodeling it into a mercantile building and a hotel, like an old western town, Warner Brothers studio. And we took, this is what it looked like when we got done. We took the gift shop, did a bunch of remodeling in there, put a couple buildings in, and ended up with the facility that looked like this. Then we built a facility across the back. After my wife said, "Do you really like what the architect put together?" And I said, "Well, I don't have anything better in front of me." And she designed this about an hour and a half later. And again, that's what it looks like right now. It's a western town with a western theme. We put modular furniture in there. And we've moved about 41 people in there to date. We moved in about 2 weeks ago. And we plan to go right through the middle of that white building back there. And we're going to put an office building on to handle another 20 to 25 people this summer with that spot. And if you look over to the right on that facility where we plan to put in a research building, I know somebody asked about research a little bit ago. We plan to move about 15 to 20 people out to that research building that are involved with diagnostics and research. And then in about a year, we would like to add on more facilities at that site. And again, this particular site showcases the Bioscience Park on the north part, which is 57 acres, which our city would like to get funded for bioscience in southwest Minnesota. Now, some things that on this last 20% of the presentation there, these are things that we think as a company that concern us in the future. And just briefly going through these things, oftentimes if you're not in a startup company, but you're 6 to 8 years down the road, you typically grow into some capital infusion issues, particularly as you're growing fast. And if you're paying state and federal taxes and building inventory and holding accounts receivable, a lot of times there's not a lot of money left for capital expansion and or research facilities, and research is what you need the most. And so just plain access to capital for building expansion and research projects is really important. And if you want to stimulate growth, capital with low interest, and I think I heard Commissioner Kramer say very nicely to the Senate subcommittee a couple of weeks ago that they want to be a part of starting out businesses, and they don't want to be the end-all financing. But boy, it makes a difference when you can see low interest at 1 to 2%. For $200,000 to $300,000, it's very hard to pass up, and it sure stimulated our group to add on a not only an office building but a research facility. And those are the things that I think that are very important that you can help with at your level. And again, they can be revolving loan fund dollars at the state level, the county levels, and the municipal levels, and the dollars that came from the Commissioner Kramer's office percolated right down, and they really were an influence for us. Local property tax relief could be given on new R&D buildings, new capital expansions. It always amazes me how counties can sit there waiting for the money and tax you full bore out of the gate, which is probably the hardest time in your life when you're starting a business. So with that in mind, I just think that you could consider tax incentive maybe for a 3 to 5 year period on capital expansion projects. It would be a real relief because that's when you get hit the hardest. City infrastructures. Helping city infrastructures is something that I think you ought to consider. You know, we've worked with the city of Worthington has been very good to us, and we've been pleased with it. But one of the things that I think everyone needs to realize is typically a company does not have the resource, time, or expertise to solve infrastructure issues within a city. So if you people can help out city infrastructures and get them the basis, companies will come in, and oftentimes decisions are made as to whether they're ready to go or not based on the infrastructures. Tax incentives, I think your job Z-zones are great. We didn't particularly qualify in the prairie export process because of the abatement proceedings that were used, and we're fine with that. Just remember this, that, you know, there's areas of the world that are being shaken out right now in agriculture. South America for soybeans, Ukraine for wheat, and the USA is going to be a corn and meat production area for not only the Midwest, but the livestock areas of the Southwest and Southeast. And having said that,
we need to continue to promote the meat industry and the corn industry for these areas. So when it comes to environmental regulations, livestock operations are very important, and the operations and permitting process are getting more restrictive, but they're still workable. And as suburban development occurs, we are going to have encroachment out there, and I know what happens with encroachment. Pretty soon, the builders are the people that are considering the livestock operations encroaching on them. And a good example of that is go to Chicago and drive west to Dixon, Illinois, and see what's happened. And that will happen in various areas. I listened to a veterinarian speaker talk about what they had done in Nebraska on the livestock area, and he says you could not believe it. It was Jim Pillen with PSD Industries. He says you cannot believe the effect that it's had on communities to permit livestock buildings and give people not only income but the ability to pay off some notes and get ahead in life. He said it's been astounding. Just to finish up here, the cost of medical insurance is always a concern. 3 years ago, we were going to have a 33% increase in our medical insurance, and working with comps is always sitting there. And we were able to scramble and do some things to hold it to a minimum. This last year's rate increase is zero for 2005, so that does give us some hope. And the last thing that we're concerned about is progressive education. And one of the concerns we have in rural greater Minnesota is to be able to get people out of a college situation and get them into a situation where we can hire them and have them be ready for the job. In Worthington, Minnesota alone, with the Newport Intervet facility, Swift, and then the medical area, as well as the Minnesota Soybean Processors, we have well over 220 people in a town of 11,000 that are in laboratory jobs. It's hard to hire people that are job ready. So what our group has done is that we've teamed up with Minnesota West, and we're putting in a job training laboratory center. We're in this research building we're building. We're going to dedicate 2,000 square feet so the Minnesota West can bring their crew in and train people. So when we get these people out of college, they're a lot more ready to go than they have been in the past. And again, we want to put this in this Bioscience Park. Hopefully, long term, the city will take over this particular training center as well as an incubator laboratory. And again, just a couple of quick slides. If you want to promote a biotech industry and fund our to promote that biotech industry, you have to fund education. And again, that's important to us out there. I just want to point out we're one of the last vestiges of a vaccine, a company that's not corporately owned, and we plan to grow ours in Minnesota, and we'd like to go from 15% to 40% of the market share, and we think we could do that in the next 10 years. But just remember, being out in greater Minnesota never allows you to be in the pole position, so just don't forget about us. And we do want to thank you for all that you've done to help our organization today. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Freeze, that excellent presentation. I do take issue with your conclusion, however. You kind of shattering my bubble here, because I thought Junkie and I were in the pole position. Who am I to say? Ripson Hamilton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Freeze, thank you for coming up and making your testimony. I just want to point out to the committee here that it's an extremely organized group. Definitely have a plan. And it doesn't only affect their company, but they're affecting many, many farmers. They're becoming world-renowned, not only locally, but world-renowned. And that's why it's so important when we're talking about bioscience that we don't get caught up in just the Rochester, Minneapolis, St. Paul, that we make sure that we're including greater Minnesota also. Thank you.
Well, Representative Hamilton, I wish that Representative Mullery could have seen this presentation here, because I believe in the last committee he was saying that, Worthington's out of it. And I think Worthington's in it. Representative Magnus.
Worthington is it, Mr. Chairman. No, I... thank you, Dr. Freeze. Good presentation, and I understand that they'll be holding an event later on here in April, and I would certainly hope you would invite the committee to come down and see the grand opening of your efforts here on this bioscience campus, and to give us a chance to all the committee members a chance to look at it.
Yes, we were going to have it on the 22nd of April, an open house, but we've changed that. As a matter of fact, this last week, it's going to be about a week later than you, but we will be getting invitations. We're going to have opening for the area, an open house for the area, but we're also going to have a pre-open house for dignitaries to come down and take a look. And Glenn here is, I'll let you tell a little bit about it because you're the one that's kind of putting that together.
Well, yeah, April 22nd, isn't that the date that we're going to go see that really big windmill in Morris? Was that the 22nd?
Yeah, we've changed ours to the 29th.
Oh, 29th, okay.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Thuringer.
Thank you. I'd love to explain more about the conference we're having, but in lieu of time, we'll be working with Representative Magnus and Hamilton getting the information out. We have another speaker from the Hormel Institute.
Excuse me, I believe Representative Clark had a question.
I'm sorry?
Oh, was that for the Mr. Freeze?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Representative Clark? Dr. Freeze?
I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the wages and income, I guess, of the people that are working. You're expanding, and you mentioned a lot of jobs that you hope to be creating and ones that you now do apparently have. Can you give us a little profile of what those jobs
well, typically, wages will be? Yes, thank you very much. Try to answer that. Typically, I feel that probably 40% of the people that we're hiring do have a college education. And I think when you develop a biotech industry, I think Worthington has noticed that we've been able to pull in people that do make more money, and certainly we pulled in a number of researchers that really add to the community. Right now, we had one of the top researchers in the world in an area that worked for us that had some visa issues. She was from Brazil. And she had to get back to Spain because she could no longer be in the United States. We talked to her this last week. We're going to try to work to bring her back in 2 years. One of the most talented individuals. And typically, people that will be hired will have anywhere from a $40,000 to $80,000 wage, which is pretty good for our area if they have a college degree in that area. And we are adding, as I mentioned, anywhere from 20 to 25 jobs a year.
Mark.
And so does that include the production jobs? I know you showed a number of
Dr. Freeze.
Number of groups of it was interesting, mostly women production staff. Is that
learning that? Dr. Freeze. Yes, the production staff will probably average in wages between $25,000 and $40,000, and a lot of those people may not be degreed.
Representative Clark?
Well, I noticed they were mostly women, so I was thinking they probably were a little bit lower paid. Did they have one of the things I liked about your presentation is that you talked about education on site, and do you have like a career ladder kind of opportunity for some of those production staff?
Yes, yes, we do. We received a grant from through Marshall, and right now we received a grant that's going to be paid out over 3 years. It's a $200,000 grant, and almost all the money went to Minnesota West to help train our people to, number one, learn more about their job and about other jobs within the company. It's a real ag-based, there's a number of courses being taught at the college to our people. We've encouraged our people to get out to Minnesota West and try to either finish up degrees or start degrees. And so for the next 3 years, we're going to be training our people through this grant. We just brought in a world-renowned researcher on influenza about 10 days ago to give a seminar, trying to have various people come in to educate our people.
Representative Parks?
Sure, I think that career ladder part is really important. I'm glad you're doing that, and I don't know if any of the other organizations have that, but I think it's so important. I come from out in that area, and I think the opportunity for people to have good paying jobs is really, really important, and often you get stuck in those low paying jobs. Thinking some of the things that used to be made in Worthington, the mostly women working in them too, but there were canneries and now at least, of course, there's other kinds of, there's still some of that going on, but these better paying jobs I think are really important. So.
Representative Clark, what town are you from again?
Well, now that's an interesting question. I
went to
school in Edgerton, but my dad lives in Kenna, which is about 25 miles from Worthington.
Do they still have that barber there?
Not in Worthington. Not in Kenna. Maybe you're thinking of in...
Kenna.
You're probably thinking of in Hardwick. Which is very far, 7 miles away.
Okay. Cool. Okay, thank you. Representative Ochemba.
Mr. Chair, I had a question for Dr. Freeze.
Dr. Freeze, why don't you just put a seatbelt on? We've got a question for you here. I'm sorry, sir.
Mr. Chair, would it be okay to get our last presenter in to, with respect to your time and have questions at the end?
No, it wasn't. Okay. Dr. Freeze? You could get a chair, Representative Tremble.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Freeze, I appreciate your presentation. I was interested in the vaccine part for the swine. Are you developing those vaccines in your labs and the swine vaccine, and how do you decide from year to year what goes into them?
Dr. Freeze?
Yes, thank you. Yes, we do develop vaccines in our laboratories. We have two types of vaccines, commercial vaccines, which once they're licensed, they could go anywhere. We have, I think, 5 to 6 full-time researchers in that area. And you ask a very good question on how we decide to change isolates. That DNA sequencing machine will either sequence and tell us what are the differences between viruses, and it shows how they relate to each other. It shows family relatedness, and then we've also do some fairly detailed work with the nucleic acid sequences. That machine will also do a fingerprint on bacteria. And so how this comes in is it allows us to really break apart and know these viral strains. If something comes in that's not in the same family, that appears complex with the bands, then we'll go to work and do some research on it and add those isolates into it. We are getting in a number of viral isolates in the next month from a large system. That the first thing we'll do for 2 months is simply study those isolates. And we're bringing in isolates. We're hiring a person from the University of Minnesota to come down, and we will study them, look at the family relatedness, and then design the vaccine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Freeze.
Any other questions for Dr. Freeze? Okay, thank you so much, sir. Okay, and our final witness today is Mr. Clint Calvert. Is that right?
That is correct, with the Hormel Institute from Austin. Clint is the public relations representative. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. Please forgive my anxiousness to tell our story, but I'm so excited to be here before you today and tell you about the Hormel Institute. We're part of the University of Minnesota, and we get many questions about the Hormel Institute because of the Hormel name, but I'm just here to assure you we do not do research on hot dogs. However, we do have hot dogs that are doing research, and so that's a very bad attempt at a joke, but it's certainly to try to distinguish for people the fact that we are part of the University of Minnesota. Hormel Foods started us in 1942. They made a gift of our institute to the University of Minnesota and put us under the governance of the graduate school. So because of the strong support of Hormel Foods and the creation of the Hormel Foundation to support the work of the Hormel Institute, we've maintained that name and that connection with Hormel Foods through the name. But we have no operational accountability to Hormel Foods. Our research agenda is set by our executive director, and we have a board that we report to that's made up of people from the University of Minnesota, Hormel Foods, and Mayo Clinic. So we want to make sure that that relationship is clearly understood. When we were started, food preservation, lipids and fatty acid was the main issue. And as time passed, we turned our attention about 10 years ago from that field to cancer prevention. I'd like to introduce you to Zigong Dong. Zigong is my boss. Excuse me. There he is. Zigong is executive director of the Institute for the past 3 years. It's been a really remarkable story of recovery as he's taken over the Institute. He's grown our Institute from 50 people to 80 people in just 3 years. In the 3 years at the helm, Dr. Dong has tripled our National Institutes of Health funding. And one of the reasons he's been so successful is when he was brought on 10 years ago, he was brought with a transition in mind to transition the Institute from lipids and fatty acids to cancer prevention. And so he's been a very prolific publisher. He's also been a very well-funded researcher. And as he took the helm, he was able to attract and bring additional researchers to the Institute to turn our focus away from lipids and fatty acids to cancer prevention. In January, the American Cancer Society said that cancer became the top killer of Americans under the age of 85. And this graphic I borrowed from their website just shows the impact on both men and women across the body on cancer. Also, cancer continues to grow in its pain and suffering that it causes people. And I hate to raise this image, But to put it in perspective, it's as if one World Trade Center tower is collapsing each day in the United States due to the death of cancer, deaths caused by cancer. So to win the war against cancer, we need to understand the causes of it. We need to know what creates cancer, and we need to target specific genes and proteins. I borrowed this slide from Johnson & Johnson, and this is from their research and development work. And what they have to say here is that they treat cancer by targeting various genes and proteins, but you'll notice a word that's present in all of these, and that's the word toxic. Many people feel that chemotherapy can be as toxic to people as cancer. It really can hurt, bring damage to the body just as cancer ravages the body. What's different about the Hormel Institute is that we have the expertise to target genes and proteins, but our emphasis is on natural compounds. Our emphasis is on novel, non-toxic alternatives to chemotherapy. Almost universally, as I talk to people, that seems to be something people are interested in. That if they could find an alternative to chemotherapy that was non-toxic, that would attack the cancer cells without attacking the surrounding cells, that people find that to be pretty compelling. On this slide, you can see that our little definition of cancer prevention as we try to explain what we're trying to achieve. Cancer prevention refers to the use of a drug or natural agent in helping to prevent cancer. And again, the focus of the Institute is on natural and non-toxic alternatives. What's unique about the Hormel Institute is we're uniquely positioned with our collaborations to bring this science forward. We have some wonderful collaborations with the Mayo Clinic, also with the University of Minnesota Cancer Center, with the University of Arizona, and with the Rutgers University. And we have exclusive access to hundreds of natural compounds with an agreement with a Russian university. And these natural compounds are brought into the Institute, they're screened for toxicity, they're moved through our various studies so that we can see what would be effective against cancer and yet non-toxic. And to try to illustrate the effectiveness of this collaboration, toward the end of the presentation, I'll show you who some of these researchers are and what they're working on. This is a vision for the Hormel Institute. It's about 50% achieved right now, and that we would like to move our core competency into other types of cancer. Right now we're doing work in prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, and skin cancer. But in our future, we would like to tackle age-related cancers, leukemia, and lung cancers, all with the same idea, looking for natural compounds as an alternative to chemotherapy. I know I've said this before, but I really want to emphasize the fact that we're looking in foods and natural compounds for a natural alternative. This is the current theory of cancer and how it initiates, promotes, and progresses. And so we look to this theory of cancer as we attempt to fight it. This cartoon is highly technical, but it shows you our approach to cancer prevention. On the top line, you can see various cancer-causing agents or cancer promoters. And those various scenes you're seeing through that slide are signal transduction pathways. At the bottom, you see different types of therapies that we're using to try to lead to cell death or to kill cancer. And this is really the core competency of the Institute. We understand signal transduction, and we understand how food factors modulate these signal transduction processes to lead to cancer death or cancer killing of cancer cells. We have a few foods here on this slide that are happy to kill cancer. And you can see some of our what I call greatest hits. These are things that we've all studied at the Hormel Institute and have published research on. Ginger, green tea, resveratrol, selenium, omega-6, capsaicin. These are all foods that we've studied there and have work in. What's also exciting for the University of Minnesota is that this is the intellectual property that we generate that has the potential to create licenses that could be sold, that could lead to commercialization. And whether you call it commercialization or taking our research to the patient, it's sort of immaterial. The effect is the same. We have increasingly brought more attention to the Institute within our Patents and Technology Marketing Office, and we've been trying to explore ways that we could move our science from the bench to the clinic. We are growing in our reputation, and this is a very exciting thing to share with you. Last year, we had a symposium that we co-sponsored with the Mayo Clinic called Dietary Factors in Cancer Prevention. We co-sponsored this symposium by bringing 30 of the most world-renowned scientists on the subject of dietary factors in cancer prevention to Rochester. We had about 120 participants overall. But what excited us the most was we were well attended by NIH funders who presented at our meeting. They were so excited about our meeting that they elected to move their study section that was scheduled to happen in San Diego this October to join us for a second cancer symposium that we will co-sponsor this year in October. So this is very promising to see that people who fund us are so interested in our work and our collaboration with Mayo that they want to bring their study section into our neighborhood instead of having us go out there. This next slide just talks about some more of the commercialization opportunities that are possible at the Hormel Institute. We have had businesses in the past that were started up from the Institute back when we were doing lipids and fatty acid research. We haven't had any businesses yet that have been started as a result of cancer research, but we're looking at that. We do have contracts for services that we have one with Alcon Labs, but we have the potential to do this again and again. We have a licensing arrangement with Pediatric Pharmaceuticals where they're continuing to fund some translational research. We have drug development possibilities, and we also have possibilities of spin-off businesses. One idea was that the Hormel Institute might become the good housekeeping seal of approval for natural compound testing. This idea was used in the past as the Institute certified a lot of the contents of lipids and fatty acids, and so applying it to natural compounds now for cancer efficacy makes a lot of sense. I want to say here that nutraceuticals and the field that we're moving into is a rapidly growing field. And so the idea of applying functional foods to the problem of cancer is one that has a lot of commercial potential. The statistic that's in front of you basically says that that field is growing by 10% a year. I want to close my presentation by just showing you the people that are working together to test these compounds and move them through the clinic. I've already talked to you about Zagong and his prolific publishing and grant support. This is Paul Lindbergh at the Mayo Clinic. He runs the Chemo Preventative Clinical Trial Network. He's also on the board of the Hormel Institute, but he has agreed already to bring Gingerol 6, a compound that we've shown to be very effective against colon cancer, into chemo preventative clinical trials. And so we're working with him to move our research from our bench into the clinic to be tested on humans. And then this is Dr. Ho at Rutgers University. And the beauty of this collaboration is that Dr. Ho is an agricultural engineer. And Dr. Ho is able to take, let's say that Gingerol 6 is as effective in people as it has been in mice, then maybe this could be engineered to be grown more cost effectively. Gingerol 6 presents a specific set of problems because we currently purchase it for $2,500 a gram. So it's very, very expensive because it's a highly concentrated form of ginger. It costs very much to synthesize. And that's down from $6,000 a gram when we first started working with it. We would hope that if this is as effective in people, that there would be a cheaper way, of course, to grow this and make this available to people. These three people working together represent an engine for natural compound testing, for natural compounds against cancer. We call this collaboration Agricultural Biotechnology on Natural Compounds as Anti-Cancer Agents. And we think that this represents the next big thing in the treatment of cancer by unpacking the cancer prevention qualities of food. The big message is that we're preventing and treating cancer with foods and non-toxic drugs. And the wonderful part of this story is this, that there are two outcomes. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there were additional alternatives to chemotherapy? That's almost a universally expressed desire. But also, from our standpoint, there's economic benefits for the state of Minnesota. If the Hormel Institute never spins off a business or grows beyond its current path, every job we add in Austin, Minnesota is a University of Minnesota job. That's a high-paying job for Austin, Minnesota. It also brings incredible cultural diversity to Austin, Minnesota. We have folks working there from Russia, from South Korea, from China, from Zambia. So we have true diversity that's brought to our little part of greater Minnesota because of the work of the Hormel Institute. And so it's exciting to me from several standpoints, but one is the job creation aspect of it. Well, that concludes the remarks that I prepared, but I'm certainly willing to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Calvert. Any questions for Mr. Calvert? Representative Zellers?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Calvert, what is the ideal growing condition for the ginger root? Is there a particular climate, or to make it so expensive, does it have to be grown in a certain environment that we are unable to grow up here, or where is it particularly farmed?
Mr. Calvert.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not aware of the growing conditions of Gingerol 6. I'm the public relations representative, and it's beyond my scope of expertise. But I will answer you this. In all seriousness, all the Institute really needs is to find an economic symbol for Minnesota. If we could find in soybeans, or if we could find in wild rice, or in something that could be grown in Minnesota, something that would be effective against cancer, it would cinch this collaboration in our work.
$2,500 a gram of value-added agriculture.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've got a few acres that in CRP that I think we'd take out to put in that kind of a grow. So I appreciate it, though. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Keller.
Professor Magnus and Clark. Professor Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you brought up a good point. I think has your institute looked at genetically enhancing some crops and looking at pharmaceuticals or nutraceuticals out there in the fields, for example, corn or soybeans, the crops we grow here, that if you could consume those or have livestock consume those, and would be significantly reduce your chance of getting cancer?
Mr. Calvert?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have not specifically looked at that. We are, that is the expertise of people like Dr. Ho, who are able to do that type of work. Our main mission is to establish the efficacy of a natural compound against cancer. But we are open to exploring any of the things you talked about there as far as from agriculture to the bench.
Okay, thanks. Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, is the Vermelion Institute working with some of the pharmaceutical corporations?
Mr. Calvert?
Mr. Chair and Representative, currently we are not, let me rephrase that or restate that. Pediatric Pharmaceuticals will be considered a pharmaceutical company. They're a company that's trying to find something in the ginger that we're studying that would be beneficial in colon cancer. And so they are funding some of our translational research. But in the field of big pharma, Pediatric Pharmaceuticals is not probably considered a major player.
Representative Park.
Do you expect that you will be working with some of the pharmaceutical companies when you get something patentable? Or?
Mr. Calvert?
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, I would hope so. Mm-hmm. The main emphasis right now is to establish what is non-toxic and natural as an alternative to chemotherapy. So if our niche, if it's toxic, we're not interested in it. So we're looking at what naturally occurs, what's naturally good for fighting cancer, and if we would be interested in both nutraceuticals, which are functional foods that would help in the fight against cancer, and also drugs that were based on the natural compounds that we study.
Representative Clark?
I wonder if you get to ask this question. You know, there are whole fields of indigenous medicine that right now does what you're talking about. And, you know, parts of the whole medical community who have awaken to nutrition and its impact on cancer and cancer prevention and cancer treatment. And I'm just wondering, I mean, right now that stuff isn't particularly expensive. You can go to a Chinese herbalist on Hicklett Avenue and get some of the things that you need, and it doesn't cost $6,000 or whatever. And I'm just wondering how you're working with, or if you are, or see yourself working with some of those folks and how that would impact some of their businesses.
Mr. Calvert?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the Hormel Institute represents the westernization of traditional Chinese medicine. So I think we're looking for what's scientifically sound. Many of the things that people are doing popularly are supported by anecdotal evidence. And maybe that evidence is 2,000 years old, but it's not been scientifically proven in a laboratory to the capacity that we can do it. Also, this field is emerging in its legitimacy to the extent that Zagong, my executive director and boss, has been invited to be a part of the Mayo Clinic Alternative Medicine Committee. So we're definitely not on the fringe. We're definitely the place that's trying to find the scientifically sound aspects of these natural cures.
For example, Claire?
Mr. Chair, I don't know, maybe my point is lost, but you know, just because Western science can't prove that something works doesn't mean that it doesn't work. You know, a very good example is ancient Chinese medicine. And if westernizing it means that it becomes more available to more of us, that's great. If westernizing it means that it becomes extremely expensive and so not available, then it's a question that I'd raise. So you know, I mean, I remember when Richard Nixon went to China, and you know, there was incredible skepticism about acupuncture. You know, just couldn't possibly be an effective you know, practice. And you know, he came back, and of course, it's, you know, it's now something that many health plans cover for various kinds of ailments. But I'm just thinking, you know, that I guess I would just say that just because Western science hasn't proven or hasn't unlocked the exact key to what might be a description from our terms doesn't mean that it really doesn't work, and or that it's not very, very valuable. I'm glad that you're working with these folks. I just hope it doesn't make it, this kind of medicine, more expensive. That's my one concern. Make it out of the realm of a lot of us who use it regularly without having to pay a lot of money.
For example, Clark, is this a filibuster?
That's it.
Okay. And the reason I ask that is I always start on time and end on time. We have two more quick questions. But if you can, you stay a little bit afterwards, Mr. Calvert, and answer some questions for members?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can.
Thank you. Representative Tremba quickly, and then Loeffler, okay. And then we're going to shut her down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for taking that step into the Western Hemisphere, and hopefully what follows is the fact that we will be able to, you know, use it in our insurance, and that doesn't happen right now. But my other question is, can we be invited to the conference in August, or is that a closed invitation?
Mr. Calvert? Obviously, you can be invited to that. It'll be in October. It'll be October the 4th. My whole world will revolve around that weekend, so you certainly can be invited. And as I've been listening today, I understand that that I'll need to send that information to you.
Mr. Calvert, I really kind of wanted to go to San Diego.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all respect, the government per diems for San Diego don't even pay for the hotel room, so it's much cheaper in Rochester, Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Calvert, I thought you were going to pay for the hotel room. Thank you, Representative Trimba. Representative Loeffler, and then we're going to shut her down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Calvert, just a quick question. I'm on the Bioscience Division of the Commerce Committee, and we've had a number of different presentations, and part of that has gone through the partnership between the University Medical or Academic Medical Center with the Mayo Foundation. Is that partnership agreement between Mayo and the university, does that cover the Hormel Institute as well, or is this a separate partnership that has a separate, you know, legal structure as well?
Mr. Calvert.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would characterize the relationship between the Hormel Institute and Mayo Clinic currently as independent researchers collaborating together on projects. We are not in the current U of M and Mayo genomics project or in any of those new structures, but we are working sort of as peers side by side on some of these problems.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Powell, the reason I asked that is because I thought it was pretty intriguing about the economic relationships as we look forward to these sorts of investments and activities commercializing. You know, in that relationship, it seemed like they had a pretty defined way of, you know, rewarding the researchers who came up with these, you know, new innovations, but also in terms of having it come back to the sponsoring institutions and how the money would be divided between, you know, all of those who put, you know, energy and effort into it. And it looked like an interesting model for moving forward as the state gets more involved.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I would really like to thank Lynn Ulsterman for putting together a panel that really did a tremendous job. So with that, good government all the time. We are adjourned.